Blue Letter Bible and Sewing Circle Ministries are pleased to provide this series of Bible lectures entitled Against All Odds by Cheryl Broderson. This weekly study in the books of Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther was taught at the Joyful Life Women's Bible Study at Calvary Chapel in Costa Mesa, California. You are listening to Lesson 17, entitled The Keeping Power of God, from Esther, Chapters 1 and 2.
Whenever I travel with Brian, there is the issue of the passports. I like to hold them, and so does he. Tickets. I like to hold them, and so does he. And he takes precedence over me, one, because he's older, and two, because of that word that I find in the Bible called submission. And I just love the thought of having my own identity with me. I don't like my identity in Brian's hands. And there's reasons for that. At the most peculiar moments, he seems to get cell phone calls. And he'll take them and he just kind of turns and forgets the rest of the world. And he's got my identity and my ticket and they're closing the airplane doors. I'm just like, Brian, please come back to me. Give me my passport. I'll ask him, please let me at least hold my own passport. And he won't even do that. He has to hold the kid's passport. He has to hold his own. I mean, he'd hold yours if he could. He's just, he likes that. And you know, it's really an entrustment. I don't like to entrust things to anybody else. I mean, Brian, I know him, but it's still so hard. I have a sewing machine and I have a friend that has asked to borrow it. And I'm just like, no, sorry. I love my sewing machine. Years ago, I had another sewing machine that my dad bought me, and it was a pin press, and it was so special. I was 12 years old, and he took me out because I had started to sew. My mom had put me in a Singer sewing class and realized I had a propensity for sewing, and I absolutely loved it. I started sewing everything on my grandma's old machine. So my dad took me out. It was a big deal. It was for my birthday, and you know, my daddy, he had seen this advertisement for this machine, and he knew that it would be good for me. I mean, it was so special. He picked it out, not me. And we went and he and I sat together for the demonstration. You know, my mom was just like, go ahead, Chuck, whatever you want. And, you know, he's mechanically minded. And his mother had sewed. So this was really special to him. There we sat and we watched the demonstration. There were different cans that you would put into the sewing machine. It was at Penny's. It was just really special to me. And I had kept it all of my life. And I loaned it to a woman in our church. And she separated from her husband and she sold it at a garage sale. I know, I'm still like that. And I've had trouble with entrusting sewing machines ever since. You know, because my latest one, Brian bought me. But you know, that sewing machine meant so much to me. And I went to her and I said, my sewing machine. She said, oh, I got rid of that old thing. You know, it made a lot of noise. I said, yeah, I loved the noise. I loved that sewing machine. It was from my daddy. And it was so special. But you know, there's so many things I want to keep and I can't. You know, have you ever had that? There's just so many things. I like to keep things. I don't know what it is. You know, but I got a brand new dining room table. The next day it had a scratch in it. How does that happen? Who are these scratchers who come and touch our stuff? You know, honestly, I wanted to keep my children little and they grew up on me. I like to keep my weight down and it just keeps sneaking up. This one, I love to keep my hair in place. There are times that I'm thinking I'm looking fine and okay, and you go home and you go, my hair did that to me? It betrayed me? Or I'll never forget the time in England when I was talking. It was a friendly Cheryl day to everybody. And I had had a lemon poppy seed muffin before I came to church. And I remember one of my daughters looked at me and went, ooh, 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 ooh. And I looked in the mirror and they were like, ha, from America. Glad to meet you. I mean, just poppy seeds galore. It looked like I had decayed teeth. It was, you know, it was not a good thing. I want to keep my house clean and neat. Oh my goodness. I don't know why. Every time I decide to keep my house clean and neat, my son Braden loves to throw a party for every young man he knows. And they like to eat pizza and have soda pop. And they like to kind of leave remnants that they were here. and there and everywhere. I just want to keep it neat. Is there any crime in wanting a clean house? Really, I ask you. He thinks there is. I want to keep my temper, especially when I see what they do to my house. You know how it is? You're like, hold on. Don't lose it. This isn't worth it. Calm. And, you know, there's that one thing that they say or they do, and you're just like, I can't believe that. You know, I find myself falling behind in so many things. My daughter Kelsey just got her driver's license, her renewal in the mail. Now, I thought I'd put it for Brian to get it, and he was sure I had it. And we argued over this. Brian, I'm not crazy. I didn't take it. You had it. It was found among my things. Keys. Oh, isn't it terrible how they just run away from you? You know where you set them, but they get up and they walk away from that place. They are keys after all. And they're looking for a place and a purpose, and they just leave. But I hate the feeling of powerlessness. I just hate that when my kids are too far away or they're in circumstances that I can't help them. My daughter, my oldest daughter, just called me the other day. Actually, she texted me. They're like, Mom, your texts are so interesting. Do you ever look at what you text or proofread? And I don't. I just figure if you hit the buttons, it'll just work. Anyway, I was texting her, and she texted me, and she said, pray. There's a situation at work. It's not good. There's this thing coming down. And, you know, there she was, too far away from me. I had obligations that day. You know, all I want to do is get a sword and a spear and go fight her battles. That's all. You know, when it's your child, you know, enemy! You just want to take it on and protect them and protect their environment. But there are so many things that, try as we might, we simply cannot hold on to. And Mordecai must have felt this way. He must have felt this way. He had Esther, this poor young woman, had already seen so much tragedy. After all, she was born into captivity. She was a young captive maiden. She was a Jew living in a predominantly Persian and Babylonian society. She was the daughter of captives. And then, as if that's not hard enough, this young girl lost both her parents at an early age. And her uncle Mordecai, who is actually her cousin, took her under his wing and he raised her. We're told that she was beautiful. And when the Bible speaks of beauty, of Esther's beauty, it uses four different words. It uses yafah, which means comely or excellent. Toar, it means in figure. She had this incredible figure, tove or tov, in personality. She was good. You could see her just, she was called Myrtle. Of course, it sounds better in Hebrew. Hadassah, which sounds so much better, in, as I said, in Hebrew. Myrtle. But she was, and that was this tree that grew in Israel, that would give these beautiful white blossoms that would turn to a red berry. It was an evergreen tree. And no doubt her parents named her in hope of someday returning to Israel. And the tree stood for a symbol of hope and joy and God's blessing. That was the name her parents gave her. But in that society, in that Persian society, no doubt her uncle Mordecai had chosen the name Star or Esther, because she was bright and she was shining and she was stellar. He had raised her, and in raising her, he had protected her from that foreign society, from harm, from persecution. Remember how he charged her not to let anyone know that she was a Jew? They had lived leaning upon each other, stripped of their family. They were of the tribe of Benjamin. But suddenly, without warning, one day, she is taken from him when she is still vulnerable. Have you ever, entrusted something into the safekeeping of the Lord only to have the very thing you prayed against happen. Have you had that? I have. I remember with my oldest daughter, she moved out here to go to Bible college. I'm living in England, and I find out she's auditing her classes. I say, I want her living on campus. They said, we didn't have any room on campus. We gave her room off campus. I said, are you kidding me? I prayed these people would not come into her life. Those people came into her life. I remember saying, should I even pray? Are we even on the same page? You don't, Lord, I don't understand. Either you're not listening, and then the voice came from heaven, or I have a better plan. And I remember the Lord used it to glut her of all those things she thought would fulfill her and to make an end of it swiftly. But I remember praying, and everything that I prayed that wouldn't happen, happened. Perhaps Mordecai had prayed all his life for Esther's protection, only to have her taken from him. He had prayed against secular influences, only to have her being put into a secular court. I believe he probably worried about her succumbing to the secular society. Think of the temptations all of a sudden that were about her. She had been a poor Jewish maiden, deprived of even the rights of those who were citizens of Persia. Again, she was in exile. She was a captive. But now there are lavish feasts all about her. She's given beauty preparations that are not affordable for the rest of society. She has 7 maids just waiting upon her. Can you imagine that? I want a drink of water. I mean, just maids. Maids. 24/7 maids. Tickle my back. Brush my hair. I mean, those things that you try and talk your kids into. You even say, massage my back, I'll pay you. And they're like, my hand's tired. Expensive perfumes. In fact, it is said that Persia has the most exclusive and ancient beauty preparations. Historians tell us, and I love this, that the women in Persia were the first to pluck their eyebrows. Oh. I kid you not. They wore makeup. They had oils and special perfumes that are still renowned to this day. And beside all that, it was 12 months of pampering. You know how dangerous that is, even for us. 12 minutes of pampering. You go home and you're like, somebody help me. I remember having my 4th child and the nurses 3 days in the hospital. See, I'd always, Brian had talked me into having the baby at the hospital and going home right away. I'd never stayed in the hospital. And I had Braden C-section, and I was there for 3 days, and they bring you food. Oh, Mrs. Broderson, you ate. Oh, I'm so proud of you. Oh, Mrs. Broderson, you got out of bed. Now be careful. 3 days. I went home, and Brian's like, now how long till you can cook? It's like, what? You know, it was like over. I'm like, you know, the nurses wanted to know how I was doing. The nurses were like, you're not in pain, are you? I mean, the others are like, little pain's good for you. It was such a difference. But she had 12 months of pampering. And Mordecai, no doubt, was worried about what that pampering would do to her personality, to her commitment. He was worried about her seduction into the wealth and affluence of that kingdom. I mean, this is a king who throws parties that last 180 days and says, you know, that was so great. Let's do it another week and invite the public. They were lavish with all the wine that anyone could drink. That which Mordecai no doubt had kept her from for her protection was now lavished upon her. 4 years earlier, there had been a feast in Shushan. Perhaps Mordecai had gone just into the courtyard of the king and seen the lavishness. I mean, you had blue and white linen curtains on silver rods between marble pillars, on floors of alabaster, turquoise, and white and black marble, these mosaics. It was gorgeous. And then gold and silver couches. Every place. Goblets. And I saw the goblet of Cyrus at the Persian exhibit in the British Museum. And I mean, their goblets were huge and they were ornate. They were encrusted with jewels. And there were many, many goblets like this and no two alike. And no doubt he worried about her and the seduction into this wealth. And their paganism and their idolatry, as they were renowned for praising the gods of wood and silver and gold before they partook. No doubt he was worried about this mercurial king who had put his wife away just 4 years earlier, Queen Vashti, because she had refused to be paraded to the people of Shushan. And it was said that he was furious and filled with rage. That's not the type of person you want your daughter to marry. That's not someone you want to entrust that which is most precious to. He was a dangerous king. In fact, that party that he had thrown for 180 days was all about going to war against Greece. And he was mustering all the forces. He was showing the people his power in order to garner support for this military campaign against Greece. And guess what? He lost. He lost the campaign. And he's coming back in defeat. The kingdom is bankrupt. And now, what will his disposition be as he's humiliated? If in his glory he was furious and filled with rage, what will he be in his shame? It was a dangerous situation that she was going into. The last queen had been stripped of her position and exiled. How would the king feel if he knew a Jewess had been put into his court? Would he be angry? Would he be upset? Would he feel that he was betrayed? Also, it was a political court. We're told that the king leaned heavily on his advisors. That was the demeanor of this king, to lean into his advisors. These advisors, they were the ones that said, you've got to get rid of Vashti. You cannot keep Vashti. They were the ones who had started the greater campaign to rid the kingdom of Vashti, saying, if you favor this woman, then all the women will dishonor their husbands. And that brought up something else. Esther, who had been a private figure, would now be a public figure. Everything that she did would do would be watched, evaluated, and weighed. And that's if she became queen. But there was the danger of if she wasn't queen, then what would happen is she would become a concubine, a kept woman in the harem of the king, unable to marry, unable to bear children, and secluded for the rest of her life from society, from family, from her own people. But then again, if she was chosen, she would be constantly watched, evaluated, and judged, and always in danger of losing her position and even her life. It was an uncertain future. And no doubt Mordecai worried about the unknown, because we're told in chapter 2, verse 11, that Mordecai paced in front of the women's quarters for 1 year, for 12 months. Where are you going today, Mordecai? Pacing. Just back and forth, just to know her welfare, because he couldn't see her. His communication was limited at best. He wanted to know her estate. There was nothing he could do. He was obviously restless. He was concerned. And he gathered whatever information he could and waited anxiously to know how she was faring behind the palace walls. Meanwhile, though, in the women's quarters, behind the palace walls, Esther was keeping Mordecai's charge. She was remembering his words and all that he taught her, and she was still obeying even in his absence. she was still mindful of her heritage and who she really was. But Esther was favored above the other women and given extra allotments. Here, have some more Estee Lauder. Esther was also secluded from the other women and taken to the best place in the house of the women. So she wasn't taunted by the other women. She wasn't persecuted by the other women. Isn't that wonderful? I mean, I would hate to be in a beauty contest. You just think of all the other women that are working hard to get rid of you. I remember that story of that woman who hired men to kill the other cheerleaders who were in competition with her daughter in Texas. I mean, that's the beauty pageant mentality. That scares me. You know, I want to be Miss Congeniality and then just stop the whole thing. Because there's a competition here. There is nothing worse than the spirit of competition. I hate the spirit of competition among women. It is ugly and it is painful. And to be in that, where women begin to say these things and just put you down and try to make you feel less and be less and take your Estee Lauder and stick mud in it. I mean, it's just bad. But God protected her, taking her out and secluding her. Esther was given 7 choice maids. She was bathed in myrrh for 6 months. For another 6 months, she was lavished with beauty preparations and perfumes. While Mordecai paces, Esther is being blessed. And then the day comes that she's to appear before the king. Can you imagine how concerned he must have been? Remember again, Esther was taken at night and then the next morning. Would she be violated or would she be chosen? And before this moment, she leaned on Haggai's advice, who was the head eunuch over the women. She went at night to the royal palace in the 10th month and the 7th year of the king's reign. If she obtained favor, she would be queen. If she was ill-favored, then her future was doubtful. And if she was simply refused, she would be a captive in the king's harem forever. But we're told that the king loved Esther more than all the other women. Now remember, this is all happening while Mordecai is pacing, going, "Oh my, what is going to happen to Esther? Oh!" All this is happening while he's pacing back and forth. It's at that moment that Esther obtains grace and favor in the king's sight, that a royal crown is placed upon her head. And then, by the next day, he knew everything was going to be all right because there's a feast given in Esther's name. And presents are given to all the people. I mean, talk about favor. I mean, the king didn't just say, "I'll take that one." He's like, "Whoa, this is so great. I want to bless everybody too. If I get this much blessing, I'm blessing everybody." I mean, he fell in love with Esther. It was incredible. What God was doing was divine. But you know, Mordecai was not through being concerned. He simply moved from outside the women's quarters to within the king's gate. And there he still wanted to know her welfare. You know, somebody said that you carry your children in your arms until they get older, and then you carry them in your heart for the rest of your life. You, as a mother, I thought when they got to marrying age, I'd stop worrying. I thought, you know, you're launched. You're going to be all right. I got somebody else to take care of you. And then you find the concerns are even greater. Those who are excited that their child is turning 3 from 2. Mine just turned 29 and it's not over. The concern, you see, you just move the concern. It just moves from the women's quarters into the palace. And that's what happened. He was within the king's gate and he's still concerned about Esther. But Esther, even as queen, even with the royal crown upon her head, even with the feast in honor of her and the rejoicing and the gifts and the wealth of that Persian court, she did not forget her cousin Mordecai's advice or who she was and the charge given to her. Mordecai, though, as he's there within the king's gate, he hears of a plot by Bigthan and Teresh, who are doorkeepers of the king, to kill the king, to assassinate the king. He is able to communicate this plot to Esther, and Esther goes and makes a full report to the king in Mordecai's name. And the plot is searched out, found to be true, and there's a public hanging. It's a brutal society that Esther is now a part of. But like Mordecai, there are things in our lives that we cannot keep though we long to. There are things that are so dear to us that are taken away, that we are powerless to hold on to. We might worry, we might pace, but it's not doing any good. It's not changing the situation. We might seek to find out the welfare that we had to relinquish, but even then it only whets our appetite to know more and to protect and help. But we must entrust this thing, this person, this dream, this desire, this possession, not into a secular court, because that won't work. But we must give this thing into the hands of the great sovereign, the Lord of all, to God himself. You know, my dad loves to talk about those electrons that spin around the neutron. The nucleus of an atom. You've got the neutrons and the protons, which naturally don't like each other. But some reason, because the electrons spinning around them, they're like, we'll be good, we'll be good, and we'll hang together. But nobody knows why the electron keeps spinning around the atoms. Nobody knows. Our scientists have come up with theories, but they don't know why. But when an atom is split, you have a nuclear reaction. Atoms are very dangerous things, and yet we're all made up of atoms. And everything we see is made up of atoms. But Colossians 1 tells us that by him, speaking of Jesus Christ, all things exist, all things consist, made up, and are held together. You see, we can't do the least. We can't even hold the atoms together. And there are times we can't even hold ourselves together. I mean, have you ever tried not to get sick like I did last week? Only to succumb to it, going, no, not me. I mean, I did everything. I was doing airborne vitamin C, this awful green drink that tastes like mud. And I still got the sore throat. You know, if we can't even do the least, why do we expect to do the greater? We must entrust to him who is stronger and greater and powerful, the great sovereign. Paul said in 2 Timothy 1:12, he is able to keep that which I have committed to him. That word keep is the Greek word philosso. And do you know what it means? I love this. It means to put a garrison around, to take care of, to keep from escape or harm. You see, God is able to keep that which we give into his keeping. Here's the secret. We need to give those things that we cannot hold into God's keeping. Years ago, there was a young girl who was going blind, and the pastor came over to her house, and he said, Tabitha, don't let God take your sight from you. Give it to him. Give it to him. You see, there are some things that often we feel like God is taking from us. And we can either relinquish it to God as a gift and put it on the altar, or we can try to hold on to it and have it pried out of our hands. How much better just to relinquish it to God, who is able to guard, to put a garrison around, to take care, to keep from escape. You see, when we look at Esther, we see the keeping power of God, don't we? There's Mordecai pacing. Oh, is she falling under the influence? Is she telling them she's a Jew? Is she safe? Are those women hurting her? Are they prejudiced against her? And instead we find she is being blessed, she is being favored, she is being protected. God is able to keep that. I don't want you to think that I don't have to live these things. Every time God gives me a study, I have to live it. I have this one daughter that I have to keep giving to God. Do you have one of those? He just, oh, Lord, oh, Lord. It's, you know, God's delivered her from so much, and it's an amazing testimony, but it's hers. But, you know, she's that child, that one. And the other day, I was talking to the Lord about her, and I wanted to keep her, and I wanted to hold on to her. She's one I just like to lock in a room for about 5 years and just put the food under the door. And I was talking to the Lord about her, and just the Lord said, Cheryl, give her to me. Give her to me. And I said, all right, Lord, I give her to you. But then a few minutes later, I found myself concerned about this, and the Lord said, Cheryl, I said, I know. So I gave her to the Lord again. A few minutes later, there I am again. And the Lord said, give her to me. So I said, okay, I'm going to do this right. I give you her hair. I give you her hair from the top of her scalp down to the very ends of her hair. I give you her face and her head and her brain. I give you her ears that she might hear your word. I give you her eyes that she might see you working. I give you her mind that she might think thoughts about you. I give her a nose that she might breathe in what you have for her. I give you her mouth that she might speak your word and your words might just be in her. I give you her neck, Lord, that she might be held up in the truth. I give you, and I went right through all the way down to her toenails and the nerve endings in her toes. I gave him everything. Absolutely everything. A little bit later, I'm on a walk with Brian and gets one of those famous calls. That's how our walks go. Brian talks to others and I talk to God. So we're walking and he stops. He stops. And you know, I don't usually stop when he stops because I'm walking with God and we keep up together. And I look and he's like this on the telephone. You know, I mean, as if the telephone can see that finger just going back and forth. And you see him go, oh. So I'm thinking, wow, this is really bad. I have no idea who this person is. So what I do is, because I'm curious, I double back. God and I double back. We pick up Brian, but Brian's still talking and he's not moving, so I just keep walking around him. So finally, he gets off the phone and he's doing that sigh. I know things are bad when Brian goes, oh, it's one of those sighs, you know. Brian sighs anyway. Before he preaches, you'll notice this. It's like he's breathing in the Holy Spirit and getting rid of the flesh. But there he is on the phone, just that sigh. And so finally, you know, I'm waiting and I'm pacing. And I said, what is it? He said, Kelsey just got in an accident. And she ripped the front bumper off her car. And it gets worse than that. She was picking up a girlfriend of hers who had just gotten in an accident. And she went to do a U-turn and she crashed into a bobcat trailer. I tell you, you see why I'm like I am? I remember saying, Lord, is this the girl I just gave you? I mean, I gave her into your safekeeping, philosophy, because I was already studying. I was already convicted. You were supposed to guard to keep. And look, Lord, look what happened. And I said, okay, I don't want to charge you unjustly. You know, I know she's yours and she probably needed this accident just to get her act together. And, you know, what is another, you know, I mean, our insurance is so expensive anyway because this is like number 5. It was just like, oh, Lord, you know, and we're walking and I want to just, you know, go, she did this and she does this. And the Lord saying, you gave her to me. You gave her to me. She's still mine. I'm not giving her back. We're walking and, you know, I'm just letting Brian do it. Just letting him vent. And it feels good. And we get home and I'm still, you know, I'm just like, Lord. And the guy calls us who owned the bobcat trailer that she hit. And he says, your daughter, it's a miracle she's alive. He said, she just pulled out all of a sudden in front of me to do a U-turn. Typical. And he said, I was able to swerve by a miracle. And she caught her bumper and hit me instead of me hitting her. And if I hit her, she'd be dead and her friend too. Because he was in a huge truck. And he said, I was in her blind area. And she couldn't see me. And he said, I totally understand. He was like the nicest guy. If you want your child to be hit by anybody, let it be this guy. And the Lord just spoke to me and said, do you see my keeping power? I kept her safe. Not a scratch on her. And then Brian said, stay where you are. We'll get a tow truck. Does that daughter listen? No. She sticks the bumper in her back seat of her car and drives home. I can't take care of this child. You know, I never have been. When she was 18 months old, we had these people staying with her, us. I was pregnant. I'm cooking food. I'm watching the other two. I get a knock at the door, and these two little girls are there. They're like dying. They're going, do you know whose little girl this is? It's mine. It's Kelsey. And they said, we found her up and around the block. And I said, yes, she's my daughter. She's like, hi, mommy. And they're looking at me like, you're pregnant and having another one, and you didn't even know where this one is? You know what it's like to be judged by 9-year-olds as a bad mother? You know, I can't keep that child, but God can. God can hold her together. God can protect her, even without a front bumper on her car. God is able to keep that which I have committed unto him. But here's the secret. Give it to him. Give it to him. Mordecai was limited in what he could do. He couldn't check on Esther. Oh, you know how we want to check? We want to just look in their room every 30 seconds. You know how we want to check on them? We want to check their cell phone. What are your texts? We want to check, you know, what are they doing? He couldn't lecture her. One more lecture. Oh, I love my lectures. Nobody else does. He couldn't watch her. He couldn't protect her like he wanted to. He couldn't hold her. He couldn't stop anything. He couldn't communicate directly with her. The closest he could get was outside the women's quarters. He was separated from her. And there were boundaries that he couldn't cross. Even in the king's gate, he was limited to the information he could glean. He could only pace and wait and pray and commit. But God was working in Esther's life, keeping her from the influences of the court, giving her favor, supplying her with choice mates, beautifying her life. But Mordecai couldn't know that. Mordecai, let's just give him a new name. Mordecai couldn't know that. I'm sick. Okay. But you see, in that place, Esther was in the transformation process. She was changing from a girl to a woman, from self-centered to other-centered, from a maiden to a queen. You see, when we entrust into God's safekeeping, it's not that he's just protecting them. He's working on them. He's working. He's doing a transformation process. He is doing what we have tried for years to do and failed. He is doing what we cannot do with our words or our actions or our example or anything else. God is able. God is able. You see, when we entrust to God, he becomes the responsible party. He is then able to work majestically. He is able to protect. He is able to safeguard. He is able to bless. He is able to favor. He is able to transform. And he is able to do what we at our best estate cannot do. But also, he is able to uncover the plots of the enemy while we are in this place. And we are able to pray against the plots of the enemy that would bring the kingdom down. You see, when we're in this place, I think about it. What if Mordecai had not been in the king's gate? And why was he in the king's gate? Because he was concerned. You see, when we're concerned and we're praying, God is able to speak things into our lives and we're able to save lives. Isn't that true? Haven't you, by the things you've had to commit, been able to minister to others who also have to commit those things to the Lord? In this place, it's not just that Esther and the things that we have entrusted to God are blessed, but God is using us as we pray, as we commit, and as we entrust to uncover the plots of the enemy and to save lives. Years ago, Brian had a friend who was arrested on a false charge. He'd just gotten saved. He was only 3 days old in the Lord. And Brian was very protective of them. They had grown up together. And it was just a false charge. It was so bad. And Brian said, Cheryl, I want to take our savings and I want to go post bail for him. I said, okay, you know, if that's what you want to do, talk about entrustment. Oh, well, goodbye, money. It sprouts wings anyway. So he went down with the checkbook and they doubled his bail. So Brian couldn't because we didn't have that much money. And he comes back and he's trying to get in touch with his friend and he can't get in touch. All doors are closed. Finally gets in touch with the chaplain. And the chaplain said, yeah, I've been meeting with him and I've been praying with him. I'll get you in. So 2 weeks later, Brian gets in to see his friend. Now, his friend had gone in struggling with alcohol. And Brian sat with his friend, and his friend says, this is the greatest place. You wouldn't even believe it. I have been able to read my Bible every single day. God has delivered me from alcohol completely. And he has met with me every single day. This book is so cool. No wonder you felt this way about it. And he said, and the chaplain, he's great. He comes in, he prays. We have these Bible studies. And Brian said, what about, you know, the other, you know, inmates and stuff like that? Oh, man, they're totally into it, too. We're, like, all gathering together. We're, like, praying and stuff. So cool. And, you know, the food? It's really good. A week later, he was released. But he had gotten established in the faith. And he's still walking with the Lord. But I remember we were pacing back and forth. Oh, God, is that the way to treat a new believer? Lord, he's only 3 days old in the Lord. What is this going to do to him? Oh, it's going to establish him. It's going to take him from an alcoholic to a believer, from a sinner to a saint. It's going to transform him. We must entrust into the safe keeping of God. We must relinquish the power that we cannot have and only try to have and give it to God. We must pray and pray and pray again. And we can seek the welfare of that person by prayer and through seeking God. When we entrust again, sometimes our worst fears happen. But know that God is in the transforming process. Behind the scenes where you cannot go and places you cannot see. And even in the worst case scenarios, God is at work.